Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Unredacted, a weekly podcast show hosted by myself and Q Anthony, who I see has just arrived essentially at the same time that I have. Good afternoon, Q. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm also good. I'm looking forward to our conversation. The first topic that we're talking about to be so shocking and exceptional and extraordinary, maybe I shouldn't, that even though I just did an hour and a half video or a 45-minute video actually on it yesterday and wrote about it several times, I still have a lot more to vent with you about, so I'm looking forward to that. And the second topic, this tragic killing of a really admired journalist in the West Bank, is a little cloudier in terms of exactly what happened, but probably the most likely explanation, though it should await investigation, is that it was something that was done by Israel, and it's just a horrible situation all the way around, and we'll talk about that as well. But how are you doing in general?
I'm I would say at least partially recovered, so I'm actually like up and about. My kids can't get away from me anymore, so that's good. They can't, you know, just like walk up and slap me and then run away. I gotta say, I really don't like not being able to do things. Like, I have a backyard garden that I was supposed to be planting already, so that's behind schedule. You know, I've got a dog that needs grooming. I've got stuff around the house that needs building, and being like a person that's always got to be up and about doing something. Like, if I'm not writing something or creating something, I got to go do something with my hands. And having to lie in the bed for like 2 weeks while, you know, these bones start to heal, it was absolute hell. So I will say, if anybody caught me the wrong way on social media over the last couple of weeks, I'm just going to apologize in advance. But I was just in a really shitty mood not being able to get up and do anything.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just as a technical issue, and maybe it's just me, but I think your volume is a little low. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I can hear you. I think the internet connection is fine, but maybe you're not close enough to the phone. I'm not sure. You know, it's interesting. I think you need to turn the volume up a little. You know, I've had those experiences before where I haven't been able to do something physically because of an injury or some other condition that flares up or whatever. Things that you just take for granted you're supposed to be able to do, and you never celebrate when you can do them. You just get angry or resentful or annoyed when you can't. And it's one of the lessons I've learned over life is it's actually important to take note of and be grateful for the things that we can easily just take for granted and not take them for granted. You know, and I mean, there are exercises like when you wake up, the first thing you do, so it's the first thought you have, is instead of thinking about all the annoying things you have to do that day or the pressures you have, instead focus your attention on what you're grateful for, even simple things like, wow, I just woke up instead of died during the night and I have another day to live, and you know, I'm healthy and my children are healthy and my husband is healthy and my dogs are healthy and close to me, you know, just that kind of conscious appreciation of the things in life that we can easily overlook until we don't have them.
Yeah, and by the way, how do I sound now?
Much better.
Okay, yeah. So I guess like I do try to be consciously aware and thankful for the things that I do have. But you're right. Like, you know, oftentimes I'll wake up and I'll think, oh my God, I've just got so much shit to do and no time to do it all. But yeah, I mean, I have a beautiful wife. I have two brilliant and amazing children. I have a healthy dog. I've got a bunny rabbit who... Even she's starting to catch attitude with me, but like, you know, we're doing really well. So on the one hand, there's like all kinds of like pressures for things that I want to be able to accomplish. But at the same time, compared to a hell of a lot of people, you know, there is much to be thankful for. Wow, you just guilted me into rather than going back to mosque the week after next, I'll just go next week. Are you there? Hello, Glenn. Can you hear me? Oh, boy. Looks like Glenn cut out. All right. So in the meantime, until Glenn is able to get back, or is it me? Am I the one that's cutting out? Okay. Audience, chat, could you please?
All right. Hopefully that's.
I was going to say it was by show of hands. If people could let me know if it's me that's cutting out or if it's Glenn that's cutting out.
I think it was probably me because right as I was trying to blame you, I was getting messages saying your internet is unstable. Okay. So hopefully I just fixed that. So, I think those things are important. It is when we don't have them that we realize them. So anyway, let's talk about this amazing vote. Yes, people are making clear that the fault lies with me.
Yeah.
I plead guilty.
That's an evergreen. That's evergreen advice.
Exactly. The internet is very, very well practiced in declaring my guilt. But hopefully I fix the problem with my incredible ingenuity. So let's talk about this Ukraine issue and that $40 billion vote. If you don't mind, just given how often I've been talking about it, I'll just put it into its factual context and then we can talk about it from there. So we're basically 10 weeks into this war in Ukraine, depending on how you count, but the Russians launched their full-scale invasion on February 24th, so less than 3 months. And I had been noticing this pattern where every 10 to 14 days, the Biden administration was announcing another seemingly random amounts, but always large amounts of money. It was sending to Ukraine, $300 million here, $800 million there, $250 million here. And when we say sending to Ukraine, we're sending this money to Ukraine, what we actually mean is, although a small portion of it is actually going to Ukraine in the traditional sense for humanitarian aid or, you know, reconstruction of civilian infrastructure, most of it, what we mean is we're sending it to Raytheon and we're sending it to Lockheed Martin and to General Dynamics and to the CIA in order to carry out U.S. war aims in Ukraine. That's really what it means. So we're sending this money to the weapons manufacturer industry, the U.S. security state in the name of the war in Ukraine. And I was noticing these amounts flying around and it was unclear to me where this money was coming from, where this authorization was coming from. And then it turned out Congress had quietly authorized $3.5 billion in Biden's discretion right at the beginning of the war, then increased it in early March to $13.5 billion. So when Biden sent over his request for $33 billion more, the U.S. had already spent, had already depleted the full $14 billion that up until that point had been authorized. So this $33 billion more that Biden was requesting was on top of the 14, which meant that it would be $47 billion just in 10 weeks. And when Congress got this request, the leadership in both parties with full commitment and equality united and said $33 billion is not enough. We should arbitrarily raise it by $7 billion to $40 billion. And so they quickly created this accelerated legislative path to ensure immediate passage of another $40 billion in expenditures, which means that just 10 weeks into the war, we are about to authorize $56 billion into this war zone. So just to put that into the context, the average annual expenditure of the United States annually in its own war in Afghanistan, which at least had the pretense of some sort of connection to self-defense, I say pretense, but there was at least an argument that we attacked Afghanistan because the Taliban had given safe harbor to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, which they used as a launching pad for the attack on the United States in 9/11. But even in it was our own war, and we spent $46 billion annually. We've already blown past that for this war in which we're not a direct belligerent after 10 weeks. That was the annual average. On top of that, while we're depicting Russia as this grave existential menace and the equivalent of Nazi Germany, and they're going to start marching through Eastern Europe and then into France and Germany and all these other fantasies, the total amount that Russia spends on its entire military every year is $69 billion. So we are very close to spending the entire Russian military budget, again, after just 10 weeks into the war. And I keep emphasizing that because it's not me, but U.S. officials who are now openly saying over and over that they expect slash hope that this war is not going to be a matter of months, but a matter of years, which means we're just getting started in terms of the money that's flying around. It's almost inevitable by the end of the year, we'll be spending in the hundreds of billions of dollars, if not soon exceeding $1 trillion. And the Congress decided that it was going to fast track the $40 billion. There was never any doubt that it would pass. It did pass by a vote of 360, I believe it's 381, I don't have the exact yes vote, to 57 no votes. All 57 no votes, every last one of them, were Republicans, which means that not a single Democratic House member voted no on this radical escalation, both financially and militarily, of the United States' involvement in the war in Ukraine. And not only does it mean that none of them voted no, all six members of the squad, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, Diana Presley, Jamal Bowman, all voted yes. They all voted yes. Even though Ilhan Omar just 2 months ago said that she believes that pouring large amounts of American money and weaponry into Ukraine would be, in her words, likely disastrous. AOC has been spending 3 or 4 years feigning to be an opponent of U.S. militarism and U.S. hegemony, wanting random 10% cuts to the military budget, correctly arguing that much of it is just waste and just goes into the pockets of defense contractors. It would be far better to spend that money here at home on American citizens. And yet they just all voted yes, just all six of them. And they haven't, to this very moment, even bothered to issue a single statement explaining why they voted that way, why they voted to send $40 billion to Ukraine via Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and the CIA. So that's the factual pattern that we have. It's almost certain that the Senate will immediately take up this bill and will pass it with close to a unanimous vote. There may be one or two no votes from people like Rand Paul and Mike Lee, although that's not even certain, but I don't think there's even a chance that a single Democratic senator will vote no. And then it'll be off to the president, who already indicated that he will sign it. So what are your thoughts on all that?
I mean, you already know how I feel about the squad, et cetera, and that there really is no left representation in Congress. The fact that $40 billion in aid, as you mentioned, it was $40 billion that had an extra $7 billion tacked on just for shits, is going to the defense industry, which in turn is going to end up in the hands of, sure, yes, the Ukrainian military, but it will also end up in the hands of Ukrainian far-right nationalists, ultra-nationalists. That is a problem when at the very same time, the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously we talked about this last week, essentially the draft of the decision leaked out showing that the Supreme Court will be striking down Roe v. Wade. And at the very same time, while there's runaway inflation, I believe it's up to 8.1% right now, there's also a shortage among, you know, many other food staples. There's a shortage of baby formula. So the idea that the U.S. is making any kind of commitment to funding another country's military defense while at home, not only are reproductive rights under attack, people losing meaningful work, union busting ramping up exponentially in the wake of many successful union drives at Amazon, Starbucks, and other retail operations. The money is needed in the United States, and yet nobody asks any questions. Nobody
puts it up for debate. The idea that the United States is able to, with the stroke of a pen, deliver so much in terms of foreign policy, and yet being able to make any sort of substantive change for domestic policy, like, at what point do you call it and say this is no longer a functioning democracy? The United States is, for all intents and purposes, just a well-financed arms dealer. It is no longer, to me, what resembles a functioning democracy.
You know, here's something that amazes me on this. Well, first of all, again, this argument that when we spend tens and hundreds of billions of dollars on foreign wars, we deprive American citizens of a decent standard of living is exactly what has been foundational to left-wing politics for decades. And, you know, we had that conversation last week about what we mean when we say the left, but I mean, just using the broadest, you know, definition of that term, even including liberals, that's been an argument that has been, you know, agreed to by essentially everybody, that the Pentagon budget is insanely excessive and inflated, and that it results in a deprivation of basic needs to American citizens. It's certainly, I could point to you and every single member of the squad and people identifying as progressives in the House caucus saying that over and over, and yet they all voted yes on this. What I have to say is, you know, far and away, the most dangerous war that the United States has been involved in decades. I mean, usually the United States goes to war with countries that are kind of a joke in terms of their ability to respond militarily. You know, Iraq and Libya and even Syria, even going further back, Korea and Vietnam. I mean, it's hard to invade another country and occupy it even when they don't have a military that competes with yours, but at least the U.S. had the good sense only to pick on countries that didn't really have a major military as compared to our own, and particularly, most importantly, didn't have a nuclear stockpile. Russia is the country with the largest nuclear stockpile on the planet. So you would think at the very least that if we were going to radically escalate each week our military and financial involvement in this war, in a country that President Obama and everyone else in D.C. for years has said is not a vital interest to the United States, there would be at least more debate and more questions asked about what are we doing there? What are we hoping to achieve? And are we making it worse? And the complete lack of debate combined with how extraordinary and radical this vote was caused even the New York Times in a news article on the House vote to kind of make clear how aghast they were that members in both parties were kind of cowed into not asking any questions, let alone expressing dissent. And I just want to read a couple of parts of this article, because again, this is not an op-ed, it's a news article. The New York Times is usually completely on board with mainstream Democratic foreign policy, especially when it involves war. And yet in this case, it was kind of loaded with one criticism after the next of the war party in Washington, beginning with the headline, which was, House passes $40 billion more in Ukraine aid with few questions asked. And then over and over, they had sentences like this, quote, lawmakers in both political parties who have previously railed against skyrocketing military budgets and entanglements and intractable conflicts abroad have gone largely silent about what is fast becoming a major military effort drawing on American resources. The total allocated, $53 billion over 2 months, goes beyond what President Biden requested and is poised to amount to the largest foreign aid package to move through Congress in at least two decades. Yet, quote, many lawmakers have put aside their skepticism and quietly agreed to the sprawling tranches of aid, keeping to themselves their concern about the war and questions about the Biden administration's strategy for American involvement. He then said, they go on. Mr. Biden's request to Congress for money and to fund the war efforts have, quote, spiraled upward, yet leaders in both parties have largely refrained from questioning them. And then the last sentence, the result has been that at least for now, Congress is quickly and nearly unanimously embracing historic tranches of foreign aid with little public debate about the Biden administration's strategy, whether the volume of military assistance could escalate the conflict, or whether domestic priorities are being pushed aside to accommodate the huge expenditures overseas. So, you know, credit where it's due to the New York Times for kind of unflinchingly and repeatedly criticizing this vote, not necessarily even on the substance of it, though it does make clear how serious this escalation is, but really kind of demanding that these members of Congress stop being so cowardly and just doing whatever they're told about something so significant without even asking questions. You think that like AOC and Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy and, you know, Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham have any idea where this money is going, that where, why this random $7 billion beyond what was requested by the White House, why that was needed, whose coffers it's going into, where these, of course they don't know. They don't care. And, you know, I guess, Hugh, like the thing that is striking me, you know, when we've talked about the squad before and that they're kind of fraudulent and more of a branding, you know, image in terms of their dissidence and whatever is, you know, too well established now to bother attempting to demonstrate. But what kind of amazes me is that it's not just them, but the kind of Bernie AOC left, as they call themselves, the people who have claimed to be so opposed to the Democratic Party establishment, the establishment in D.C., certainly militarism and war. Where are they in this debate over Ukraine? Like, they don't want to come out and defend it. You know, they, it's kind of like the same thing with the debate over internet censorship. No one on the left wants to come out and say, yeah, I'm supportive of, you know, Homeland Security and the security state and big tech and the Democratic Party censorship regime on the internet. So instead of, you know, doing that, they just kind of abstain from the debate altogether and ignore it, because they also don't want to say they're opposed to it, because most people on the left want this. And by the left, again, I mean this broad definition of the left. But in when it comes to Ukraine, you don't have the right to abstain. This is an incredibly dangerous war. And yet, you know, other than like a Chomsky interview on a YouTube channel with, you know, 3,000 subscribers hosted by a 25-year-old kid, or, you know, a couple of like more marginalized voices in left-wing media, there's just no participation whatsoever from the kind of mainstream liberal wing of the Democratic Party when it comes to Ukraine. And I've seen almost no anger that the squad, even though their votes weren't even needed, like the one thing the squad usually is good at doing is casting votes that create the false appearance of being dissidents when their votes aren't needed. They'll never do it when their votes actually matter. But in this case, no one needed their votes. They had so many Republican votes that it was going to pass even if they voted no, and not one of them threw even kind of a token no vote to appease their followers. I think that says so much about where American liberalism and the certain sort of Bernie AOC wing of that party is, and what they actually stand for.
The Noam Chomsky interview, actually, I thought does have a little bit of insight. If you want, I can pipe it into the room. I think the audience should hear it, because I think even Owen Jones was a little bit surprised at how forceful of a condemnation that Noam Chomsky had for the defense bill. Did you want me to?
Yeah, let's see. Let's absolutely hear that.
All right, in 1 second. Okay, are you not able to hear it?
Yeah, I don't think we can hear that.
All right, just one sec.
Is possibly the Ukraine, we have to think through it carefully. There is possibly, there's one way to bring the agony to an end quickly. That's negotiations and diplomacy. There's no other way. negotiations and diplomacy always mean offering both sides something they can live with. That's the nature of diplomacy. That means, in this case, offering Putin some kind of escape hatch, some way to get out without admitting total defeat. That's diplomacy. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is to reject that. So far, we're just talking logic. Then we ask, what happens if you reject it, as the US and Britain do? Well, if you reject it, you're carrying out a grotesque experiment, gambling with the lives of Ukrainians, and in fact, the world. You're carrying out an experiment to see whether Putin will slink away quietly in total defeat, or whether he will use the capacities that Russia, of course, has to devastate Ukraine and set the stage for going on to maybe broader, even terminal war. That's the experiment. And that's the experiment that the US and Britain are undertaking. The US position now is that we have to, that the war, that the goal of the war is to weaken Russia. So we have to go on with the war until it weakens Russia sufficiently. That's actually a replay of what happened with Afghanistan in the early 80s. We could go into that. But just think what it means for Ukraine.
Yeah, so that was actually a little bit surprising because Chomsky, in my opinion, has sort of drifted towards this centrist, pragmatic approach. And on some issues, I think, issues that are beyond the level of simplicity that he describes them. I'm thinking of, for example, the war in Syria. Oftentimes, he will side with the quote-unquote pragmatic approach and veer towards U.S. intervention. But it does seem apparent in the last week, I would say, seeing that article from the New York Times where, you know, there's just an explicit exhortation. Hey, hang on a second, guys. Like, we really got to think about whether we want to commit to this long term. And we really have to think about whether what we want to do is force Russia to capitulate, whether we want to humiliate them, or if we are willing to take whatever victories we can, i.e. Russia was not able to take over the entirety of Ukraine. They were not able to, you know, essentially dislodge their government and demilitarize the country. Now they're fighting for specific regions, and many of them are close to the DPR and LPR regions that declared themselves independent anyway. So as far as what their intentions were going into this war, they don't seem to have achieved them yet. Why not take a step back and look at a way towards negotiating an end to the violence? But that's not what the consensus is in Washington, and it's not what the consensus is with U.S. media. I'll take a step as far as to say that that's not the consensus for Canadian or U.K. media either. And yet, according to the very same reporter, well, these are things that even Ukrainians aren't even asking for. And what it seems to be the case is that Putin is correct that the United States and NATO countries broadly are using this conflict as a proxy war with Russia to further weaken and destabilize the country and perhaps even create regime change.
You know, the thing that was amazing is I remember in the first week or second week of the war, I hate trended on Twitter for, I think, like close to 72 hours for saying that it seemed clear to me that the U.S. goal in this war was not to protect and defend Ukraine, but to sacrifice Ukraine in pursuit of its goal of trapping Russia inside a proxy war that it would have to fight for years in order to weaken that country. And at the time, if you called this a proxy war, you were immediately accused of spreading Russian propaganda because it was the Kremlin who was saying this is not actually a war between Russia and Ukraine. This is a war between Russia and NATO and the United States, which is enabling and fueling and funding the war in Ukraine, as they've been doing for many years, encouraging Ukraine to militarily confront us, to avoid a diplomatic solution, over Crimea and eastern Ukraine. And now, you know, just a couple months later, U.S. officials and people in the Congress are not only calling it a proxy war, just the thing you weren't allowed to say 2 months ago, but are saying this is our war and we need to fight it and win until the end. They see it as a zero-sum game now. There's no diplomatic solution. There's no off-ramp. It is either Russia wins or we win. And by we, it's not Ukraine. It's the United States. And I think one of the reasons why Chomsky's comment surprised Owen Jones, and part of the reason why I splashed it all over the internet when I heard it, was in part because Chomsky was kind of more restrained at the beginning, because I think that first week or two, it was an incredibly repressive climate. It reminded me of the week or 2 weeks after 9/11, when there was basically zero room to express any kind of questioning at all about U.S. policy. You know, a month into after 9/11, Barbara Lee was the lone person in Congress willing to stand up and vote against the war in Afghanistan, not because she didn't think that Al-Qaeda's attack was horrific. She said it was, but she said, I really question what this is going to achieve, and we're probably going to be there forever and accomplish nothing, and a lot of people are going to die for no reason. And she turned out to be incredibly prescient. And for saying that, she was, and people have forgotten what she went through. She got real death threats. I mean, the overwhelming consensus of the right-wing media was that she was a terrorist and on the side of Al-Qaeda, and the climate at the time was so repressive that most people couldn't find anywhere near the courage that she did. The ACLU wasn't even willing to represent Guantanamo detainees or war on detainees for at least a year because of how much heat there was on anyone who did. And that was pretty much the climate that got created immediately after Russia invaded Ukraine. We saw way more media coverage and the imagery that is the atrocities that take place in every war. But this time, instead of those being hidden from us, they were shown to us endlessly. And so even Chomsky, you know, was a little bit more cautious in his messaging. But this is the Chomsky, you know, of the last 60 years and his views on war. And one of the reasons why Owen Jones was kind of startled and unsettled to hear it was because Owen Jones is one of the people who have been saying from the start, I'm all in on the obligation of the West to fund and arm the Ukrainians, not just to observe that Russia was unjust in terms of its decision to invade or violate international law, but specifically in the debate about what the role, the U.S. role should do. And this is, you know, this is, Q, I think the thing that's missing is this idea about what is a vital interest and what isn't sounds like a kind of technocratic Washington foreign policy blob, you know, think tank debate that justifies you. But it's actually crucial for making rational moral decisions about how we behave in the world. Because obviously, when something's a vital interest to your country, meaning a direct threat to your country, you're willing to do more to defend it than if something isn't a vital interest to your country. And you have to make those decisions, because otherwise, you're going to be what has always been disparagingly referred to as the world's police officer. You're going to, you know, supposedly take responsibility for going around intervening in every single war that breaks out, regardless of whether you have an interest in it. And it was, again, President Obama who always emphasized, because he comes from that kind of realist foreign policy school of like Brent Scowcroft and Jim Baker. He really loved like the Bush 41 guys. That was really his kind of inspiration for his foreign policy. And when he was being pressured by both parties for years to send lethal arms to Ukraine, especially right after the Maidan revolution / coup, that imposed a much more pro-Western government in Kiev, and both parties in Washington were saying they need lethal weapons to defend themselves against Russia. He was resisting. And when Jeffrey Goldberg on his way out conducted an extensive interview with him, he kind of, you know, Goldberg did, being a new conservative, kind of angrily pressured Obama about why he didn't do more to send lethal arms to Ukraine. And Obama said, it's very simple. If you look at history, if you look at a map, if you look at geopolitics, Ukraine has always been is now and always will be of vital interest to Russia because it's right on the other side of their border, the most vulnerable part of their border that Germany twice used to invade Russia in the 20th century. But Ukraine is not and never will be of vital interest to the United States. So the idea that we're going to risk war or conflict with Moscow over things like Crimea or border disputes in eastern Ukraine, said Obama, is madness. And that is the point I think that Chomsky made that was so important, which is why I wanted people to hear it and why I'm glad you played it. Because what he's really saying is, look, believe all you want that Russia acted immorally, hate Putin all you want, but there's nothing more threatening to humanity than the possibility of the outbreak of war between two nuclear armed powers and the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons. Obviously, the U.S. twice used nuclear weapons during World War II. Those were, you know, kind of a joke compared to the potency of nuclear weapons now, which are humanity ending and earth destroying 1,000 times over. And the people who are doing this are really trifling with an extremely dangerous situation. They're really playing a dangerous game, which is that they're saying their desire to take vengeance on Russia for what they believe the Kremlin did in the 2016 election and helping elect Trump and defeat Hillary, or just their general contempt for Russia in general, is worth risking nuclear war over. They're basically doing an experiment, just like Chomsky said, that we believe that we can openly boast about all the ways we're attacking Russia, and we're betting that Putin won't react in any sort of escalatory way that involves nuclear weapons or the threat of nuclear weapons. That's a gigantic gamble.
And it's not just go ahead. I was going to say, like, it's a hell of a lot of money to spend on G-checking somebody. You know what I mean? Like, this is... I hate to do like hood analogies or whatever, right? But like, that's not only like lifting up your shirt to show the piece in your waistband, but it's like handing it to somebody and watching them pistol whip you with it and then waiting to see if you retaliate, right? It's just like, it's the most insane strategy for what they call maintaining global security that I think I've ever seen. You can't continuously escalate, well, not only escalate war, but then through a proxy, but then brag about how your intelligence led to the sinking of one of their warships, how your intelligence led to the killing of high-ranking military officials. If the situations were reversed, if this was, I don't know, the U.S. like invading Baja California or something like that, and Russia was providing intelligence that managed to take out high-ranking generals and U.S. warships, there would absolutely be retaliation. No question about it. And I wonder what it is about the culture inside the Pentagon that has people feel so carefree with not only making these assists, and obviously it's being done so with Biden's blessing. Like this can't be done behind his back. So not only is Biden giving the okay to this, but they're bragging about it in public. And I don't think I've seen anything, not in my lifetime at least, I haven't seen anything like that. Not even, you know, if we want to talk about the Iraq War, that was different. Ostensibly was for the same purpose, you know, defending democracy, et cetera, taking out a crazy dictator and all of that. But there was at least some sense of national shame. Like there was a significant portion of the population and of the electoral body, at the state and federal levels, where people were openly expressing some sort of contrition about this, that when Iraqi citizens died, there's a reason to feel bad about it. And that when areas like when Fallujah, for example, is the site of a pitched battle that is so destructive to the surrounding environment that children are being born with birth defects due to their parents' exposure to depleted uranium rounds. Like to this day, like that is a source of national shame. The Abu Ghraib prison, source of national shame. But like now, it's like any insane idea that you float or that you hear has actually been carried out, nobody wants to offer a dissenting point of view. Like, maybe this is a bad idea. And I can't understand. Like, I'm not even just talking about like dissent for dissent's sake. I think a problem that Americans experience is this idea that there are no rational actors, that like everybody who is foreign leader that's not aligned with NATO, not aligned with strategic partners such as Saudi Arabia and Israel, that they are insane people, that Xi Jinping is a madman, that Putin is a madman, Kim Jong-un is a madman. They cannot ascribe rational motivations to any of these people or to the people that live in their countries. And if you create an enemy that does not think or act rationally and therefore cannot be reasoned or understood with, then any action you take against them is therefore justified. And I'm not sure how the U.S. body politic managed to talk itself into this viewpoint.
Well, it's so interesting. This is one of the really interesting things, right? Is, you know, for 20 years, American presidents from both parties have been dealing with Putin. And they've always walked away impressed with his intellect and his rationality, even if they found him menacing or whatever. Like, no one ever claimed that Putin was some kind of, like, sociopathic psychopath or madman. He's been in power for many, many years and never did anything once to suggest that he suddenly bent on, like, some kind of Hitlerian genocide. But the thing is, there was this narrative that immediately arose that completely contradicted what DC has been saying about Putin for 20 years at the start of the war, which is that he's now had a break with reality, from reality, speculation that he's suffering from some disease, some fatal disease, that he's old and he doesn't think rationally anymore, which, if true, that's all the more reason not to play games with the possibility of nuclear escalation. Like, the reason to hope and to bet that that Putin wouldn't escalate that way is by betting that he's rational. And yet, simultaneously, there's this narrative that he's some kind of genocidal Hitlerian madman, which rather strongly suggests that that's not a safe bet. But, you know, the thing that's so amazing to me, you know, I've noticed this before this war, is American wars have such an amazingly consistent pattern where when new wars are introduced, and this has been going on since the Cold War, the American public overwhelmingly gets behind them because the bipartisan propaganda and consensus is so overwhelming that it convinces people to support them. Korea and Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, on, Libya. And then at some point, 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, public opinion completely reverses and says, it's a mistake. It was a mistake to have done that. So you would think that that would teach people, hey, the next time there's a new war and you're starting to get swept into this vortex of bipartisan propaganda, maybe stop and use your critical faculties to wonder what it is that you're being led to believe that may not be true. And it's incredible to me, you know, if people want to justify the U.S. aid to Ukraine and the involvement in the war, they'll say things like, oh, well, this is a case where the U.S. is acting morally because we're defending a democracy from tyranny and aggression, as though that's the first time that has ever been said about an American war, when in fact, every single American war, every single one, all the ones I just named, were justified based on exactly that claim. I mean, the Vietnam War, the story that the CIA told was that the South Vietnamese Democrats were our ally. They were being brutally assaulted and attacked by the North Vietnamese communists. And we were there to do nothing more benevolent than to enable the people of South Vietnam to be free. We were there defending our democratic allies from attack by a despotic country. Obviously, in Iraq, we were told in the first war that Saddam Hussein was a madman who tore babies out of incubators. And then in the second war, we were told that we were going to free the Iraqi people from this monster who used, chemical weapons on his own people, which he did while the United States was a very close ally of his and was supporting him. And that's always the moral framework that gets put on everywhere. That's not new for this war. And I just am amazed at how many people are willing to believe that the United States decides to get involved into wars, to spend hundreds of billions of dollars, to deploy its military through some benevolent desire to protect people, as opposed to the reason that most large countries get involved in a war, which is because they perceive that doing so is a way to advance their geopolitical self-interest. It's amazing to me to just watch over and over the same propaganda narrative work.
Every single time. What really pisses me off, though, is that I'll see people who are in their 20s and even 30s say that they are, you know, that they would have never fallen for the Iraq War propaganda. And I'm like, but they did the exact same thing then that they're doing now. The playbook hasn't changed any. There's been no deviation from the playbook. It's reduce all of a foreign country's, like an enemy foreign country, reduce their entire population down to one person, and yeah, then make that person out to be a psychotic tyrant, and then tell people that it is the moral obligation of the United States to step in and save those people and the neighbors of that country from this despotic madman and their sycophants. It's been the exact same every single time. It's what they're doing with Xi Jinping. It's what they've done with Kim Jong-un and previous to him, Kim Jong-il.
Like Gaddafi and Assad.
Gaddafi was the worst one because the idea, I think maybe this worked really well because Libya is, it's a Northern African country. Majority of the population is Berber or black, but they're identified as pretty much like Arabic, right? That's generally how people think of like everybody from the Middle East and North Africa, that they're just Arabic. So that he gets lumped in with everybody else. And, they made him out to be this insane dictator, this tyrant. Never talked about the level of development that existed in Libya prior to its destruction by NATO. The fact that the Libyan currency was, I believe at its peak, was like somewhere around 82 cents US, had the highest level of social and economic development on the African continent, people were, I would say, fairly happy. Well, when I say happy, I mean that their material circumstances were certainly better than all other countries on the African continent. You could probably argue the difference with South Africa, but in my opinion, Libya was more economically advanced than South Africa was at the time. So you disregard all of those factors and you make it a moral obligation to wage war to liberate people. And then you leave these countries in a far worse condition than they began with in the first place. And then you convince yourself you've done a good job. And when all the atrocities come out afterwards, it was a mistake. Wash, rinse, repeat. And this has been happening. I mean, in my lifetime, the first time that I saw this was during the Persian Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. And it's been the exact same ever since.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you the time when I saw it most clearly, because it happened shortly after I began writing about politics full time, and so it was very, attuned to everything going on, was in, I started writing about politics in late 2005. And in 2006, neocons began really pushing the idea, which they always wanted from the start, that it was time to move from Iraq to Iran and do regime change there. And there was this one notorious quote from an anonymous neocon in Time. It's almost certainly Richard Perle or Paul Wolfowitz. That was, real men want to go to Tehran, that they're not content to have done regime change in Iraq. It was time to go to Iran. And people forgot this because it didn't work. But what happened was in 2002 and 2004, Karl Rove, a very shrewd political strategist, used anti-gay referenda on state ballots basically amending the Constitution to ban gay marriage to ensure that the evangelical voters on which George Bush depended would actually turn out in the 2002 midterms and 2004 presidential election. And it worked. They did turn out and they won both of those campaigns. Suddenly, out of nowhere, in 2005, 2006, there started to appear these stories in the Western press pushed by the very same neocons that the Iranian government was mistreating its gay citizens. You know, stories about gay men hanging from a crane and being pushed from the rooftop. Like, all of a sudden, we were supposed to believe that the U.S. government was, like, so deeply concerned about the plight of Muslim gay men in Iran. And it was accompanied by the insane elevation of a fairly standard Iranian politician, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who had been elected president in 2005, ran for re-election in 2009, was term limited out of office in 2013 because the Iranian constitution limits the role of the president to 2 terms. He left office. He was repeatedly depicted as the new Hitler. And, he, you know, of course, he was anti-Israel in the same way that most of the Arab world was, and most Persian politicians need to be in Iran in order to survive. But the idea that he was some sort of Hitler figure was insanity. But that was when you see the playbook that suddenly Iran, this incredibly complex country of 75 million people, who in fact were governed by, you know, a religious body of Ayatollahs from the Iranian Revolution. The president was kind of a prime minister figure at best. Suddenly, we're all supposed to personalize Iran to Ahmadinejad, believe that he was the new Hitler, like we're now being told Putin is, and we've been told so many other people are over the years, in order to get people so angry about their treatment of gays, about, you know, Ahmadinejad. And it didn't work, but that was the playbook that you can now find every single time being used. And I don't know whether it's just kind of historic amnesia that comes from the fact that every 10 or 15 years, a new political generation comes of age. Like, millions of people who participate in our political discourse now did not live through 9/11 or the Iraq War or the subsequent early years of the War on Terror as an adult, or they weren't born, or they were too young to have remembered it. And so they're very susceptible to that kind of propaganda. Or if it's just that these propaganda techniques are so finely tuned over the years to really stimulate our most primal emotional needs of how we need to belong to a tribe and an identity, a national identity, and feel superior. But whatever it is, it works amazingly well, even though the playbook really never changes. And to watch it now in Ukraine, where people who should know better really are so gullibly convinced that the goal of the United States is to protect democracy in Ukraine, when we can all listen to the audio of Victoria Nuland, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, choosing the Ukrainian president for them in 2014 and aiding in that so-called revolution. The United States have been running Ukraine so openly that Burisma, when they wanted to pay somebody to gain access to the real leader of Ukraine, didn't pay the son of a Ukrainian politician. They paid Hunter Biden because it was Joe Biden running Ukraine. That's the democracy of Ukraine that we're there to protect. It's very, you feel like, especially at the beginning, it's almost like you're just banging your head against a brick wall trying to penetrate that propaganda.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think propaganda takes us into the segue for the next thing that I wanted to talk about. But just to make sure that we have enough time for our callers, I'll try to keep it as short as I can. But last year, I'm not sure, Glenn, if you saw this happen, but when Israel began launching its offensive against Gaza, and you know, there were retaliations from Hamas. There were, you know, rockets fired in retaliation. But, you know, this wasn't an out of the blue scenario. This happens almost every single year, and it always happens right around Ramadan, either in the lead up to Ramadan or during Ramadan. There are spontaneous acts of violence by the IDF against Palestinian people. Usually this will begin where, let's say, somebody is mistaken for a militant, or somebody is behaving suspiciously. But this leads to, you know, not a person being questioned or a person being detained, but somebody being killed. So during the month of April, there were 23 Palestinians that were shot and killed. So during the course of the month, it was almost one person on a daily basis that was being shot and killed. Right. So on the 1st of April, the very first day, a man named Ahmad Yunus Al-Atrash was shot and killed during a clash with Israeli forces. And then after that, there were three men that were Palestinian fighters. They belonged to Islamic Jihad. Three men that were killed then led to a crackdown on people going about their daily business. So somebody, for example, that was not a combatant, but died as a result of the violence was Muhammad Ali Al-Gunaim, 19 years old, and fatally shot by IDF. Gadda Sabatine, who was declared to be acting in a suspicious manner, was shot and killed at point-blank range. There's actual video of this. On the 10th of April, another woman was killed. That's Maha Khatem Al-Zatari was killed near the Ibrahimi Mosque. And then, as we saw on multiple news stations, there was a raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And, you know, people were brutalized, they were detained, and you saw it described in news media in the West as unrest, as conflict, tensions rising, etc. But what you actually saw were IDF soldiers, you know, inside a place of worship, guns at the ready, in full, like, you know, battle attire. And you had worshipers that were, that were being detained face down, and people outside the mosque that were being chased down and beaten, including, elderly people and children. And of course, this is like this every single year, this fucking happens. And then obviously, when you start going into people's places of worship and, brutalizing them and committing acts of violence against them, there's going to be retaliation. People are going to be defiant. They're not going to follow orders because they feel that, you know, in the land where they and their parents and their grandparents and all their ancestors were born, they're being brutalized in their own land by occupiers. So now we have a situation where Shireen Abu Akleh, a journalist with Al Jazeera and somebody who's very familiar to viewers across the Middle East, North Africa, was shot and killed. And by almost all accounts that I've read, people said that there were no Palestinian militants anywhere nearby, and that she was killed by a sniper. And I've seen passive language used to describe her killing that's ranged from Palestinian journalists killed during clashes to journalists hit in the head by, or sorry, died after being hit in the head by a bullet. That little marvel was brought to us by Forbes. They later deleted the tweet. But the problem I have with that is that last year during the bombing of Gaza, Canadian journalists signed onto a petition, which I helped boost, that demanded Canadian news media offer more balanced coverage of the assault on Gaza. Because previously, and especially during Operation Protective Edge, which was, in my opinion, a genocidal campaign, one in which more young people were killed in that conflict than I believe since the Sabra and Shatila massacre. But in response to Canadian journalists asking for more balanced coverage and less explicitly pro-Zionist coverage, or at least coverage that talks about both sides as if one side is just choosing to be bombed or it was their fault, journalists who signed on to it, many were reprimanded by their employers, and a couple of CBC journalists were taken off of their beat. Like, they were removed from their assignments. And now that, especially after having watched the way that everyone from politicians to pundits to just regular old people on social media just respond with foaming outrage at every single time that Russia is accused at having committed some sort of atrocity, whether it's the massacre in Bucha, whether it's massacres outside of Kharkiv, whether it's a missile being dropped on Donetsk City, and you know various acts of brutality, accusations of rape, etc. Every single time these things come up, people are very quick to condemn Russia and demand that the international community act swiftly to punish them for it. And yet, by all accounts, a Palestinian-American reporter, she's an American citizen, not that it should make a difference, but you know, when a foreign country kills an American citizen in the course of doing her duties, you would expect that there's at least some grave response. And it's almost crickets. There was a call for an investigation, which I think is fairly reasonable. But the fact, I mean, this is not the first time this has happened, anything like this. You know, there were Canadian medics during Operation Protective Edge that were inside of a UN building that was bombed by Israel, and two of them died. And the response from Stephen Harper at the time was, well, we should figure out why the UN had that building there in the first place, basically apologizing to Israel for Canadian citizens being killed. And by the time that this drops out of the news, and by the time that Israel investigates itself and finds that it did no wrong, there is going to be no answer for this, no accounting for this. And the double standard, I think, is it's infuriating. It infuriates me as somebody who does believe in Palestinian liberation. I think it infuriates people generally that are at the very least sympathetic towards Palestine. I think it's infuriating to journalists who are worth their salt and actually hold principles, and to many young Palestinians that watched Shireen on the news and themselves wanted to grow up to be journalists. So the complete double standard we've seen in the past couple of months, I think, is it's absolutely atrocious. And frankly, it makes me in many ways ashamed to be part of the journalism community. If the compassion that you experience for one of your colleagues being killed while just trying to do their job is conditional on where they were born and ostensibly what political causes they might support.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot there, and I'll refrain from covering we're talking about pretty much everything. So we leave time for callers, especially since my views on Israel and Palestine have been, you know, expressed in countless places and are well known. You know, I do have to say I try very hard and I usually succeed in avoiding pessimism or anything approaching like resignation when it comes to political causes. But Israel Palestine sometimes is the one thing that can really just make me feel like a sense of impotence and hopelessness. I mean, the cards are just so stacked against the ability to change that situation for so many reasons. You know, even this kind of anti-interventionist, America first ideology that Trump, with whatever motives and for whatever reasons, nonetheless did import into Republican politics for the first time, would obviously militate against the U.S. being so tightly close to the hip with Israel. And in fact, one of Trump's earliest comments that I think caused a lot of the anger and hatred and concern from neocons and the CIA was he actually gave an interview that was considered a huge gaffe when he was said, well, I don't understand why the U.S. is so completely on the side of Israel. We should be a much more honest dealer, an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine. Why would we, you know, be on the side of Israel? And then immediately he got reined in and was spoke at AIPAC and gave the standard or even over the top, you know, hardcore pro-Israel speech. And then his administration was nothing but, you know, the standard one-sided blind support for Israel, if not even worse. It's happened other times where little bits of the truth have came out when David Petraeus testified before Congress. I remember when he was a beloved general, he said that his experience in the Middle East has taught him that one of the leading drivers of anti-American sentiment is the widespread perception in the Middle East that the U.S. is the enabler of Israeli oppression of Palestinians and Israeli aggression. And of course, had to immediately apologize as well. For that, there's been just every time the little truth comes out, it gets smashed. Even when Trump introduces an ideology that ought to give an opening to say, look, I mean, Israel is a foreign country. if it's in our interest to work with them, we should. But being tied at the hip at that with them at endorsing everything they do is an insanity. It actually undermines our interest in so many ways, to say nothing of the morality. It's just, it's exhausting, because Israel is such a more powerful country than its adversaries, the Palestinians, that it's almost impossible to compete in terms of organizing and money and politics and in countries where you would least expect it, including here in Brazil and certainly in the UK and obviously in the US. The playing field and the media narrative are so tilted in one direction. You know, you see votes in Congress where people can't agree on very much, and every time AIPAC writes a resolution about Gaza or Israel or whatever, it passes like 427-3. So obviously there's a very one-sided narrative. I do think we should wait for an investigation to definitively assert who killed this journalist. Obviously the much more likely explanation is the Israelis did it. You know, I guess I have a hard time seeing why they would just all of a sudden purposely shoot and kill a very popular Western journalist, but you know, it could be inadvertent, it could be reckless, although it could be unintentional. But you know, either way, as you say, by the time there's an actual investigation, even if it concludes anything, which it won't, it's going to be forgotten about. The US won't do anything about it. And it's all going to just kind of keep plodding forward. So that for me, whenever Israel and Palestine are discussed, is the thing that I have to resist and combat the most, is that feeling of kind of just resignation sometimes. So anyway, unless you have other things, why don't we go ahead and take questions? What's that?
Yeah, we can go ahead.
Okay, great. The first person, and when I call on you, go ahead and unmute yourself, is Andrew. Hello, Andrew. Go ahead and we should be able to hear you.
Hi there. So I had a question I had asked Michael Tracy. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the question and his answer as well, because I found his answer equally convincing and kind of terrifying. And it was about red lines for the whatever anti-war movement might actually exist. And obviously it would exist outside of DC, but be kind of in the streets, which doesn't exist now. But I'm wondering if there's any red, I asked him if there's any red line that the US could cross in Ukraine that would, or NATO, that would trigger some kind of movement in the streets, because I don't think it's going to be an electoral thing. We don't have time for that. It's going to have to be about forcing the people in power to do something. And he basically said that he thinks that whatever that trigger would be too late. It would be some kind of conflict in Ukraine. It would be boots on the ground from NATO or the US. And at that point, it would be out of hand. And I just wanted to know what you guys thought about that, both of you. And if there is any prospect for some kind of anti-partisan, anti-war movement in the US, because obviously it would need to be bigger than whatever's on the left or the right alone.
Q, do you want to take that?
I personally think
that there's a line that the United States could cross that would set off like a mass anti-war movement. I think for the most part, people are just so beaten down by the circumstances of living through this pandemic, and then the, you know, massive economic instability we've been experiencing for the last couple of years, and then this on top of everything. I think that people are, at least from what I can tell, are just very introspective and are looking for how can I just manage my own situation. And I think that if you like scroll through social media, you'll see all kinds of people saying all kinds of insane things about the war in Ukraine. And I think that if you keep your head in social media, it tends to way out index people's sentiments out in the real world. Not that it's that much different, but like you get the idea. You're going to be magnetized towards the most insane takes and think like, wow, if everybody thinks like this, we're fucking doomed. I think it's more so that people that may have otherwise been energized into a cohesive anti-war movement are just so, I guess, like financially and emotionally depressed by their own circumstances, that it is very hard to build a cohesive anti-war movement. There are definitely still people and organizations that are out there. I mean, I I can't go a day or two without seeing an email in my inbox about this, that, or the third protest that's taking place, whether it's labor activism or whether it's anti-war or whether it's, you know, against the intrusion on women's right to choose. I mean, there are all kinds of events that are happening, but as for like the general sentiment, I don't know what the U.S. could possibly do outside of the U.S. borders that would cause a mass anti-war movement.
Well, I should say, this is why I find the squad vote so significant, even if it's not surprising. Because for anybody who is remotely on whatever faction you want to call it that is left of center, liberalism or center left or the actual left, whatever, in order to identify with an anti-war sentiment or with distrust for the endless war machine or the ideology that leads to it, you need to be able to find or identify some leader with whom you identify who is acting in defense of that vision. So even if you had like one or two squad votes and maybe like one or two progressive, non-squad progressive votes, you know, like a token three or four vote camp against this escalation, at least people could kind of cling on to that and rally around that and find some sort of inspiration in it. But the fact that the entire Democratic Party, unanimously is united with no dissent behind Joe Biden's just completely unhinged and spiraling escalation in this war after, you know, Bernie Sanders spent years telling them that the CIA fairy tale about Russiagate was true and that we should all be enraged at Russia because of their interference with our democracy. What it's doing, in my view, is it's teaching, you know, this new generation of not just liberals, but kind of these soft leftists to identify with Bernie and AOC and who are never going to look to the Republican Party for anything that should guide them. They're seeing this united front in defense of this new war policy, this incredibly significant war policy. And rather than triggering an anti-war movement, which, you know, might happen if people get angry and desperate enough in their material situation and start to link it to the money flying out of the door for Ukraine, or at least, you know, start to realize that their leaders' focus is not on them. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, it was incredible what she said yesterday. Obviously, a little bit concerned about that, though not very, because it was a throwaway line. But she basically said, hey, if you're out there, meaning like you working class idiots, and you're like wondering, hey, why are they spending so much time in Ukraine? Why are they sending so much money to Ukraine when I'm suffering? She told them, just pick up the Bible and read the Gospel of Mark about how you fed me. Because that's what we're doing in Ukraine. We're feeding them. And that's what the Bible teaches us. So if Nancy Pelosi thinks that people's anger or confusion about why so much attention to Ukraine when they're suffering is going to be assuaged by some barely disguised, contemptuous and patronizing decree that they should go read the Bible, I think she's going to be in for a big surprise. But I don't think she's, you know, wrong to assume that there's not going to be much anger and public protest against her and, you know, the Democratic Party, because when has there been for her to worry about? Not since the 60s. So, you know, you can talk about Occupy, which was a serious movement, but got crushed pretty quickly by Democratic mayors. I think, you know, the Washington class feels very insulated right now from any kind of public pressure. And it's hard to blame them for that.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing that got me worried about this was the leaks about intelligence, U.S. intelligence being involved in potentially sinking the Moskva. And between that and the zero resistance, essentially, to all of the military aid, it makes me wonder how many steps, intentional or otherwise, away are we from something there's no turning back from. And it's just amazing to me that no one in Congress seems to care or feel threatened at all or nervous or, you know, a sense of self-preservation. It's just kind of mind-blowing. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, we couldn't offer more optimism. Maybe next time. The next person is Eric, I think. It's hard for me to read names until they light up, but I think it's Eric. So
I just want to say one more thing, which is that Nancy Pelosi quoting the Book of Matthew. Jesus Christ, dude. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Book of Matthew. And this is so the passage itself is from Matthew 25, chapter 25, verses 31 through 40, right? And, you know, this is talking about, you know, what will happen when the Son of Man returns, right? And the passage is to say, like, do good things in your life now and do things like exercise charity and be as generous as possible, because what you do for the most unfortunate person that you can find is the same as doing it for the Lord. And so that's where she came up with the whole, you know, for I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I don't even think that she actually, did she actually get the verse correct? Hang on just one second here.
The impact that it is having on food for the world. So when you're home thinking, what is this all about? Just think about when I was hungry, you fed me, in the Gospel of Matthew. It also is so pleased that Mr. Meeks.
Okay, so the verse is, for I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. And the thing that was going through my head at that moment was like, there's a food crisis happening right now. There's a shortage on baby formula. A friend of mine, her best friend, just got sent to federal prison for 5 years for marijuana trafficking. And there's still a pandemic raging. And you want to send $40 billion to Ukraine. Like they weren't sending this money to Ukraine in the form of, let's say, food, medicine, etc. No, it was arms. I don't know. Maybe I'm just like not as aware of the Slavic physique as I thought I was, but as far as I understand, Ukrainian Slavs cannot synthesize nutrition by eating anti-tank missiles. Maybe it's just me. I don't know.
When I lacked javelin, you javelined me.
Oh my God. I don't know, man. Sorry, go ahead, Eric. I didn't mean to take so much
time. It does speak to the, you know, our nation is quite religiously, shall we say, unique in the Western world. And even our ostensibly leader of the left party, third in line to the presidency, is, you know, if George Bush had said that something like that, maybe I remember at the time when, you know, that would have gone into the whole, he's a psychotic, the next Hitler, who's, you know, a holy roller and all these things. But no, actually it turns out George Bush was a very nice president, and he, you know, compared to Trump, oh gosh, he was so much worse. And it really has driven our politics. And I think to try to split the baby with your guys's debate over whether the U.S. has a left party, it's like, you know, there's the relative left position within the U.S., which, you know, there's a left party, but actually relative to, you know, to A, the global left, what the global left consensus would be, and also B, what a reasonable, you know, objective, you know, a person's take on what that would be is not left. But, you know, I don't know, insofar as there is a contingent of Americans who would say, you know, when whichever campaign I vote or, you know, I participate in, it's to do whatever is the most leftmost thing. That, to my mind, is what you would call a leftist. And what are they, 8% of the population? But who knows? They could be a very organized and influential percentage, or, you know, come up the works. But the big thing I want to talk about, okay. Oh, actually, before I forget, hey, Glenn, do you ever think about doing, because, you know, sometimes we'll be having these little chats and the dogs will come in and start barking. And I just think you should just have one of these, you should just have a little cozy session where you just, do a video chat and just bring up all the dogs and just introduce them all and just say, you know, let them bark into the camera to their heart's delight.
Well, it's funny. I actually started a series on Twitter, I think about 6 or 8 months ago, where I was introducing each day each of our dogs and sort of telling their story. And then my husband stole my idea and decided he was going to do it through video each day, so you'll see them shortly. But people actually get angry now if I do a podcast or an interview and they don't hear a dog barking. So yeah, it's a good idea.
Well, it's a good signature to have. As for the topic, you know, I'm a, you know, I like to say I'm a, well, you know, I guess me and you have that in common, Glenn, because we're, you know, former backers of the squad who kind of now are thinking that they're not doing their job properly, shall we say. They're not serving their purpose, whether that's for lack of trying. I think it's for probably it's lack of vision and it's cowardice. But, you know, I was sort of getting a little kick out of the way. And I think it's illustrative. Maybe it's too esoteric a point. But remember when AOC wore the dress and then on her Instagram post, she talked about Marshall McLuhan. The medium is the message. I mean, you know, you remember this? And it just got me really thinking, because now with Hillary Clinton wearing that dress, where she had the famous women sewn into her, you know, the names sewn into the, you know, very subtly, I guess, because you couldn't really see them unless you kind of looked in, but into the dress. And it just reminds me, it's kind of like when you see like a plastic bag that says green, it has a little recycling symbol on it, says, this is an eco-friendly plastic bag, because it tells you, oh, actually, yeah, reuse this. You can reuse this plastic bag. And it's like, you know what, if you understand the point that the medium is the message, then you kind of realize, okay, well, the medium is luxury ballroom gown. So whatever message you run, even if you write on it, like, you know, tax the rich or, you know, anything on it, it doesn't matter, because, you know, the medium is itself the message. The medium is going to the Met Gala and being photographed while, you know, and then you think about, like, what is the actual meaning of it is that while Hillary Clinton, you know, is waltzing around, it's because of her that now, you know, we lost three Supreme Court justices, because in her vain attempt to, you know, make herself, you know, this central figure in history, she didn't seem to care that she would be a weaker candidate against Trump. And essentially, you know, you can sew Amy Coney Barrett's name in that dress now at this point. That's her legacy. So that's kind of a big thing with me, noticing that. And I don't know if anyone else noticed that as well. Because the thing with the squad, I guess, to put a point on it, is that they want she wants the little brownie points of pointing out, like, yeah, I know the reference to Marshall McLuhan. But it's like, yeah, but you've totally misapplied the reference in a way that's just like, you know, the Annie Hall scene. You want to dig him up and say, you know, actually, he's a friend of mine, AOC, and he would, you know, think that you are totally fake.
But I mean, that should have been that episode should have marked the end of any, even of the most gullible people, maintaining any kind of faith in the, like, dissidents of the squad. And she went to the Met Gala, the most, like, extreme expression of the tawdriest and most gluttonous aspects of capitalism, capitalist excess, and celebrity culture. And she wore an extremely expensive designer gown. It was in the middle of the pandemic. She was attended to by a team of mass servants while she and her boyfriend were unmasked indoors. They were doing her nails and her feet and her hair and her dress and her makeup. And she had such contempt for her supporters that she figured, oh, I'll just spray paint tax the rich on the back so they'll think I'm doing something actually subversive. As though, you know, any of those liberal celebrities at the Met Gala would be offended by a tax the rich message. I mean, it would have been one thing if she had, like, said, kill the rich or eat the rich. That, like, might have been a subversive message that might have offended the people at the Met Gala, although probably not even. But, like, tax the rich? That's just, like, the fact that so many of them were willing to applaud that. You know, I mean, it seems like an insignificant culture war episode, and maybe it is. But to me, it just signified that she has just given up on any attempt to do anything other than just, like, feed her followers. Kind of like what Nancy Pelosi did with the reading of the Gospel of Mark, you know, anything more than just some kind of symbolic crumbs that they can feed on and kind of keep hope alive. But I think it is an interesting question, like what happened to the squad. You know, I did interview AOC in 2018. I interviewed her for an hour and I kicked the tires hard on, you know, not just the slogans, but the underlying thought and the conviction she had about them. And look, she's a talented politician, which means that they're very adept and skilled at making you hear what you want to hear. But nonetheless, I do think there was some authenticity to what she believed. Obviously, 4 years later, there's not even a shadow of that AOC to be found. And I do think it's an interesting question about why that happens. You know, I do think they're threatened by Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic establishment, that if they step too far out of line, they're going to be denied committee assignments and all of that. But Chris Hayes actually wrote a book, ironically enough, called Twilight of the Elites, right before he got his MSNBC primetime show, in which he argued very persuasively that there's this thing called cognitive capture, in which if you enter and are embraced by an elite institution, no matter how smart you are, no matter how well-intentioned, no matter how sincere you are about entering it in order to subvert it from the inside, eventually it will capture your thought process. You will start to see the world through its prism because you're just ensconced inside of it, and it has so many potent reward and punishment mechanisms to keep you in line that you will over time get conditioned. Now, obviously, Chris Hayes is exhibit A to the validity of that theory, but I think that explains to a large extent the squad. Like, they're not, they didn't plan in advance to deceive people. I think at least most of them started off like with a genuine set of beliefs about their outsider status, but the fact that within a very short period of time, they all got, you know, put very loyally and reliably into line is kind of a testament to how these systems function.
Yeah, and then they want to say, like, vote for us and give us power. But it's like, you are not using the power that you have. So,
yeah, how would the world be different if Joe Crowley still occupied that seat representing the 14th Congressional District instead of AOC? I can't think of a single way the world would be different. Thank you, Eric. Really appreciate it. We have a little bit of time left, so let's try and get one or two more in. Go ahead. Q, can you see the name? If you're the person in the queue who's up next, just go ahead and unmute yourself.
Yeah, I can see it, old man. It's Silky. How you doing?
Thank you for pointing out my elderly status. Go ahead, Silky. There's a little microphone icon at the bottom of your screen that should have a red line through it, indicating you're muted. So to unmute it, you just have to click that a couple times.
Yeah, the very bottom.
Be able to unmute yourself.
Very bottom there, lower right hand corner, next to the thumbs up icon. All right, maybe move on to the next one.
Yeah, come back next time. Sometimes it's hard to unmute. Go ahead, Andrew.
Andrew, you killing?
Same thing.
Yep, same thing. Andrew, killing us, bro. All right.
We're gonna move to the next person.
For everybody in the queue, you want to look at the lower right-hand corner of your screen. There's a little microphone-shaped button with a line through it. Just make sure to tap that once you're up.
What is the next name, Q? Is it Lance?
Lance, yes.
Okay, Lance, you're about to be in the spotlight, so get ready to unmute yourself. Go ahead.
Lance. Do you think that maybe, like, some of them, I don't know, like, fall asleep or start doing other things while they're waiting? Who knows?
Yeah. Not being sure. And then they're just away from their family calling them. Let's try the next person, which is Kurt. I'm now very determined to see the name since my age was and my youth were insulted. Go ahead, Kurt.
Curl.
Oh, it's Curl?
Sure is.
Fuck. All right. Curl. I don't know. Is that maybe there's a glitch where sometimes it's just difficult to unmute because it seems unlikely that four people in a row would not be unmuting. But we're going to keep going just because everybody's heard our unmute speech by now. The next up is Johnny.
Yay, it worked for me.
All right, there you go.
Yay, it worked for me. Okay, so I'd like to plug in a show real quick. My show, it starts at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time tonight. It's called The Divorce. And the power behind it. And what I talk about is how we can divorce ourselves from the oligarchs, neoliberals, and the corporations that have captured our state, and how we can have the power to get it back. So I wanted to ask you, Glenn, real quick. Last week you had...
Awesome. So everybody, I just want to interject there and encourage people to tune in because, you know, it's easy to follow people who already have a platform. one of the great things about Colin and places like it, Substack, Rumble, is there are a lot of people who you may not have heard of before who are offering some great content and perspective. So definitely, you know, kind of explore and experiment. And if Johnny's here, that obviously means he's a person worth listening to. So check out his show.
Thank you. All right, go ahead. Very much, Glenn. Last week, you'd given a definition that I thought was really, really interesting about power. And what you said, let me start off and maybe you could remind me. It had something to do with power is when you can get a person or a group of people to do something in your interest, in your best interest. Could you repeat that again? You recall?
Yeah. For, you know, I've thought about this a lot over the years. And I think, like, what does it mean to say someone is powerful or an institution is powerful? And to me, it means that someone has the ability to use rewards or other forms of benefits that you can lavish on somebody in order to induce them to act in your interest or to reward them for doing so. And conversely, you can impose punishments or some other form of deprivation as punishment for people who act against your interests.
Right. So on that right there, I started thinking about this strategy. And what I talk about my podcast is an actual true blue strategy to get our country back. But it's really, really radical. So I want to talk about how it is that, in my view, protesting doesn't do it. And I use this analogy about protesting. I was part of the CWA in Fort Worth years ago. And I recall how in one of those meetings, we were talking about arguing and trying to figure out whether or not we can get a contract with the company through AT&T. And I realized then that our problem, and I told this to the membership, I said, you know, our problem really isn't getting a contract with AT&T, because it's out of, in my view, out of the goodness of their heart that we even have a union and that we're having to battle for another 3 years. Our problem is much more deeper, much more bigger than that, and that is neoliberalism. I introduced neoliberalism to the membership, and I also introduced a concept, a heterodox economic perspective called modern monetary theory. So that's that, right? So Alan Greenspan said a while back when the neoliberal era first started, and he was a big, you know, architect of it, said he called it the great moderation. He said, get it to where people are so in debt and so afraid to fight for their jobs that they won't start a union, right? I think that our weakness can become our strength, and our weakness is time, and at is time, and then our oppressor's strength can become a weakness. If we can create a situation where we have the time to go and talk to our local police officer and create a situation that it is so dire that the police officer has to make a choice, either to stand for the people who are in a position for revolution to get our country back, or he's going to stand with the corporations. Because it's real clear, at this point, there's no argument. We can no longer call ourselves a government by and for the people. Now, this is dangerous. No argument there. It's really dangerous because you could say, and you could argue that, well, that's exactly what they want. They don't want, you know, a society. They just want areas where they can buy and sell. But I think that we can overcome that danger. Because when you really put in that position, it's the real deal. It's a real deal. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks a lot for your time. And hopefully, you know, it don't have to be this strategy, but it can be something else. But one thing for sure, absolutely sure, that is that nothing less than a power equal than what they have will do it. If we don't do that, if we cannot do that, then all this, they're going to lead us right into World War III. And we can do nothing but blame ourselves, because ultimately, it is upon, and we are going to be held accountable, because we didn't have the courage or the smarts or the intelligence to do what we needed to do to stop these bastards from taking our country and killing people around the world. So there you go.
All right. Well, that's a very good advertisement for your show. I think it'll probably inspire a lot of people to listen in general. I'm always supportive of anyone who, instead of just trying to analyze problems and identify them and understand them, which is actually important, is also trying to think about strategies for how to work with fellow citizens on solutions to them. So I think that's an important endeavor. All right. I think this will have to be the last call. We're above our hour and a half mark. Go ahead, Chris. The floor is yours. If you can unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Hey, yes. I'm a German living in America on a green card. And from that perspective, I was wondering what your thoughts were on how Europe is handling this crisis, and particularly Germany. Seems like they're on a suicide mission. And to come back, what you mentioned about corporate capture, if that maybe has to do with the fact that the so-called intelligentsia in Europe is also captured by, you know, that German Marshall Fund, the European Endowment for Democracy, and that it kind of proves that, you know, Germany is still a vassal state and Europe in general seems to be playing along, and whether this is the empire's last play, according to Lord Ismay, you know, to keep America in, Russia out, and Germany down.
Yeah, you know, I actually find the obviously Europe has been largely behind the United States, although not entirely, which is an interesting change from, say, the Iraq War, when Germany and France were both contemptuous of the U.S. role. I'll never forget being in Paris at some conference at the height of the Snowden reporting, and I was on a panel with French intelligence officials and I think a couple French military officers, and was just so amazed at the utter hatred and disgust and that kind of typically French condescension that they used to speak of the stupidity of Americans who just wouldn't listen to the French arguments against going to war in Iraq. You don't see nearly that level of division now. Although Germany, of course, is the most interesting because they have cultivated a very close relationship with Russia. The German program in the post-World War II era has been to focus on economic growth and not being a military power. It's worked very well for them. And now suddenly, you know, I think Germany is probably taking the brunt of the economic hit from the NATO
sanctions.
Yeah, I mean, from sanctions and the cancellation of Nord Stream 2, which the
and it's coming
wanted.
It's coming ironically also from like the Green Party that was elected on like a peace platform and a green platform, and instead of getting cheap, fairly clean natural gas through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, they're now getting dependent on American dirty fracked liquid natural gas shipped on
containers. Much more expensive. And if there's one thing I know about Germans, it's that they just like spending more than they need to on anything. The kind of incredibly virulent anti-Russian strain in the Green Party, the German Green Party, has been something I've noticed for a long time, and I think is reflective of this successful effort to contaminate the kind of, you know, again, mainstream left with this like very militaristic approach to countries like Russia. That's why I say I find Germany so fascinating. I do wonder how long the Germans are going to be willing to endure this. I think I saw some comments, or someone mentioned to me some comments from the chair of Volkswagen, essentially saying, look, this war needs to end. Like, we want to sell our cars.
Yeah, I think so, there's a shift going on right now. First, everybody was waving Ukrainian flags.
Uh-huh.
And I think propaganda only gets you so far until sort of reality hits.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of people are rethinking it. But I also don't see that. I can understand why America is doing this. You know, it's making Europe dependent on U.S. energy. It's obligating everybody to buy U.S. weapons. And, you know, it's basically weakening a major competitor to the U.S. economy. But I just don't see any point in Europe or Germany in particular to have played along with this game.
Yeah, I mean, you know more about it than I do, but my expectation is that we're going to start to see in many countries that similar pattern. You know, polls show that the U.S., the Americans are largely behind the kind of abstract notions about the U.S. supporting Ukraine and the like. I genuinely wonder how long that's going to last when, again, people start to see how those policies are directly affecting and undermining their lives. And I agree with you, propaganda can only get you so far. So yeah, I why I've been looking at Germany as kind of a bellwether of what I think will start to happen in pretty much every other country other than the UK, which is both irrelevant and beyond reason. I don't know. What do you think about that, Q? Like, what do you think about how these economic harms are going to start to change public perceptions less about the war?
My answer to that is people aren't stupid. Like, occasionally I'll go into like Twitter spaces and I'll like, you know, try to have conversations with people like outdoors while breathing fresh air. And I'm getting a sense of like underlying tension bordering on panic right now. The idea that there doesn't really seem to be a game plan that any of our governments have. And the only solid plan that they did have was countering Russia. I think, I don't know, some people were even expecting the Russian Federation itself to collapse. What I'm getting at is that when circumstances turn for the worse, it's not like people do have the attention span of goldfish, but they do have fairly lengthy memories as far as their own concerns go. And I think it's going to be very difficult to convince not even just the voting public, but a public that might show up to your house very angry that the circumstances that led to their material immiseration were completely out of your hands, because we had many choices over the last 2 years and we seem to have picked either a compromise with disaster or just chosen disaster itself.
Yeah.
And lastly, could I ask if you have any thoughts on Finland joining NATO? And
oh, my Christ.
Whether they might actually...
Okay, so if anybody knows anything about me, they know that I have no love for Finland whatsoever. I think as far as, like, countries in Europe that, like, got off the hook for their support of Nazism, Finland would be top among them.
I totally agree.
Yeah, the amount of atrocities that they took part in, and, you know, what they used to defend themselves is that, well, you know, we were siding with the Nazis against a greater evil, which would be the Soviet Union. But what it really was that they were sore after having gotten their asses thrashed during the Winter War. So there's been a very strong anti-Russian, like anti-Soviet, which translated into anti-Russian sentiment ever since. Earlier this year, like even as late as like January, and in the run-up to the invasion in February, it was less than half of the Finnish population that favored joining NATO. And now I believe it's somewhere in the range of like 3/4 of.
Yeah, Finnish. Almost 80%.
Yeah. So that's not altogether surprising to me. Good for them. Good for them. Because frankly, you know, when the collapse happens and the revolutions come, in my opinion, the Finnish should be first up against the wall.
Well, also because, I mean, they enabled Hitler to, you know, to go to war against Russia and enabled the Battle of Stalingrad, where almost over 1 million Russians perished.
Yeah.
And then they signed a peace treaty in 1947. And shortly thereafter, the Russians actually let him off the hook, 50% of the debt they were supposed to pay. And I think in 1992, they signed a neighborhood treaty again with Russia. So I was wondering if Glenn, maybe as a lawyer, if actually their ascension to NATO might actually be a breach of treaty.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at those treaties carefully enough to offer anything like a reasonable or meaningful opinion or even really an informed one. I'm sure I'm also not an expert in international law from as a lawyer, but... you know, the concern that I have is the geopolitical one, which is, you know, for 20 years, Washington has been unanimous in recognizing that not just that Moscow views NATO expansion as threatening and provocative, but that NATO expansion is in fact threatening to Moscow. Like, they look at how Moscow sees the world from their perspective, and they, of course, know that if they were in the seats of the Kremlin, they would view NATO expansion this way as provocative, and that's how they know the Russians genuinely see it that way as well. And the fact that right in the midst of this extremely dangerous confrontation, we're doing the exact thing that we know is most provocative to the Russian leaders and is most designed to make them feel encircled and threatened seems like madness to me. But that madness is what has shaped this war from the beginning.
But how come that all the experts from Henry Kissinger to Noam Chomsky, you know, Hudson, Mearsheimer, they all agreed that this is madness. Yet in the media, both in the US and in Europe, it's like, oh, it's in Russia is the aggressor, and if you don't agree, you're a Putin puppet. How did that narrative become so enshrined and so like widespread?
Yeah, I mean, that is essentially the common narrative that runs through almost every Western debate now, is if you diverge from, you know, liberal orthodoxy, by which I mean neoliberal ruling class orthodoxy, you're instantly maligned as a Kremlin propagandist. It's almost reflexive at this point. All right. Well, I feel like we've come to the end of our show. We covered a lot of ground. Is there anything that you want to add, Q?
Oh, sorry about that. I had myself on mute. Yeah, no, I would say that, you know, I'm pretty much covered everything that I want to cover. But, you know, good chatting with you again. And definitely looking forward to our conversation next week as well.
Yeah, me too. Thank you to everybody who participated, who waited in the queue, who we didn't get to. We apologize for that. As always, our show keeps growing. Like every week, the audience is getting bigger. And that's because you keep coming back, because new people keep coming. So we're super appreciative of that. You know, speaking for Q, I think we both really enjoy this opportunity, because the quality of the and sophistication of the questions are always uniformly very high. And that makes it really enjoyable to do. So thank you to everybody. Q, I will see you next week at our regular time, which is Thursday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern. And I hope everyone has a great week. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.